Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news, and whatever else might come up on those emails. And you can participate yourself using email, that'll be next week, or on the phone, and I'll be giving out those phone numbers in just a moment. But before I do that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, I wanted to start with some very interesting news that was published in the current issue of PLOS Medicine, which is an online medical journal that carries a lot of very interesting stuff. And this one is all about genetic variation. We've talked about SNPs and genetic variation on the show, and now that we have the Human Genome Project completed, we're starting to realize that there's a lot of people who spell their DNA a little bit differently, and those changes in spelling can have an effect on the activity of the gene product and sometimes on the way other genes behave. In the case of this particular SNP, as they're called, which stands for single nucleotide polymorphism, and they have such sweet names. This one's 9P21. Isn't that catchy? Well, anyway, 9P21 is a genetic variant which is known to affect heart disease risk. And so in studying it, Dr. Jamie Ingert, who is one of the principal investigators on the study that was just published, was looking at this known SNP that confers increased risk and how diet might ameliorate or worsen that risk. Now, it's interesting because if you have two copies of this gene, and there are lots of people, European, South Asian, Chinese, Arabs, it doesn't really matter where your family comes from, this is a human DNA variant. If you have two copies of this, you have double the risk of heart disease of people who have no copies of it, and it's about 1.3 if you're a heterozygote or have one copy. So two hits on this is a fairly significant risk factor for heart disease, and I would predict that within the next 5 to 10 years, we'll probably be screening for 10 to 20 genetic variants for this type of DNA. But this one's important because the researchers looked at diet, and what they found is fascinating. If you eat a diet high in fruits and vegetables, and that's more than 5 servings of fruits and vegetables per day, serving being one small piece of fruit or half a cup of a fruit or vegetable, and you have this bad DNA, so that means twice the risk of heart disease if you eat the standard American diet. If you actually eat the 5 servings of fruits and vegetables, your risk of heart disease is the same as if you didn't have any of this bad DNA. So it makes you hugely sensitive to the environments. And that's a really, really important bit of information. Looking at the next big thing. Now, we've seen that they've really got these robotic arms and legs very much elaborated and designed now because of all of the unfortunate people who've had arms and legs blown off in the last 10 years fighting for our freedom, which you could argue is going to war in Iraq. But anyway, that's, you heard the quote marks, right? So the thing is, that's really spurred development of scientific and medical technology, as wars usually do, ironically enough. Now, the problem is, what if you don't have a stump with muscles that you can twitch in order to activate your robotic limb? Well, in a first, researchers actually took a paralyzed adult male and implanted a computer interface directly on the surface of his brain. Yep, right over the part of the brain that controls the arm. So here's what they did. They took this postage stamp sized electrocartography grid and they opened up the brain of Mr. Tim Hemmes and made a little window, opened up the skull, put this directly on his brain, closed it up, ran a wire under his skin out to his chest with a little USB port or some sort of plug. I'm not really sure it was a USB port, but anyway. And he initially trained by moving a ball with his thoughts on a computer screen. And when he had gotten to the point where he could move the ball forward, backwards, right, left, up, down, using 3D glasses, they then hooked it up to the robotic arm. And he was able, by thinking about moving his arm to move the arm forward, backwards, right, left, using the same thought interface, muscle to thought interfaces, very similar to what is being done with the new robotic limbs. So test of concept, and the wires were then subsequently removed. So this was only the very beginning of this. We still have to figure out how long can this thing stay in there. There's obviously infection risk and surgical risk and all sorts of other things. But the idea that you can do this with an implantable electrode and actually drive a robotic arm is a very intriguing proof of concept. Now, I was just talking about genetic variation, a related story that came out recently. I found extremely fascinating. There is a gene called the serotonin transporter gene, and there are various alleles for that. There's one fairly common allele occurring in 1 in 5 people. And what this allele does is it makes you very sensitive to your upbringing. In other words, you've probably noticed that sometimes you have people who are really, at least looking from the outside in, they look like really bad parents, neglectful, hostile, maybe even absent. And yet the children who grow up in that bad upbringing are fine. You know, they seem to revert to type and be nice people. Sometimes you'll find people who seem utterly obnoxious who had great parents, and you're like, what's up with that? Well, at least on the first instance, it turns out that if you have a particular allele, a short homozygous allele, in other words, two copies of the short gene for the serotonin uptake transporter, you are exquisitely vulnerable to your upbringing. In other words, if you have happy, nice, supportive parents, you will be exceptionally upbeat and optimistic as an adult, way above average. If you have, on the other hand, neglectful or hostile or toxic parents, you will be exceptionally badly off and distorted by your upbringing. The other 4/5 of the population are not as vulnerable to their early childhood environment as people who carry this DNA. Now, what we do with that particular information and how we use it to better mankind, I'm not ready to get into here, but I thought, wow, it turns out that the genetics, just as we talked about with the dietary influences, these sort of statistical things that we identify, you know, this diet associated with lower heart disease, within that big clump of people that forms the statistic, there's going to be a subgroup that is much more vulnerable to these environmental influences. And if we can identify those people and get them on an appropriate track, we're going to vastly benefit them. It's not going to be a 2% improvement. It's going to be a 20 or a 30% or maybe even a 90% improvement in that person's quality of life or duration of life. This from Iris in Florida, Orlando, Florida. My husband, Carmelo, and I have been listening to your radio program for several years now. We're very grateful we found you for the wealth of information you give us, your listeners, as well. My husband in particular has benefited greatly from several suggestions you've shared on your radio show with other callers. My first question is regarding bronchopulmonary aspergillosis. I have a sister-in-law who is living with this condition and finds herself very frustrated with current treatment, needless to say, the physical state. She's on prednisone and levofloxacin. I don't know the milligrams right now. Is it curable? What meds or supplements besides the one she's taking right now are in the horizon? Is there someone in the New Jersey area you can recommend that practices holistic medicine such as yourself? I'm very perplexed by the treatment that your sister-in-law is receiving. She is taking prednisone, which is an immune suppressant, and levofloxacin, which is an antibiotic. This is not the usual treatment for bronchopulmonary aspergillosis. Again, it's very confusing. Normally, this is treated with antifungals, and sometimes also, in cases where it appears to be invasive, the person will receive both antifungals and colony-stimulating factors. In other words, the stuff that we give to the cancer chemotherapy patients after their white count drops. Now, she's not receiving the standard therapy, so there's information that's missing from your question. However, I do think that in terms of finding a holistic or a functional medicine doctor, go to the Institute for Functional Medicine. Their website has a physician finder, and I hope that you'll be able to find someone close. But, you know, New Jersey is a place where I would expect there are quite a few functional medicine practitioners, although I don't know anyone in particular. As for the HCG diet, what info are you able to share with me? Is it safe? Did a little research on my own, but would like to get your take on it. My chiropractor is launching this diet soon. He himself has lost 25 pounds since June and his secretary 42 pounds a year without gaining it back. He will be offering sublingual drops for a 6-week period. Thank you, Dr. Don. God bless to you and yours. Iris. Well, Iris, let's start with the last question, which is the HCG diet. I have seen so much interesting information coming out on this, and most of it's anecdotal and sales pitches. Okay, it's interesting though, because the anecdotes, including ones I've received personally from patients, are pretty powerful. So I do think that this stuff is not a placebo, that it actually works as an appetite suppressant. And I think that the mechanism is probably an effect on the hypothalamus, multifactorial, relating to the way that the hypothalamus responds to the hunger hormones that are produced by your body fat. The exact mechanism, I think, is still being elucidated, but that seems to be the gist of why this works. It's, you know, hitting that central nervous system, which is, of course, where all the drives live. That being said, rapid weight loss is something I discourage. For one thing, when you dump a lot of fat quickly, you set up physiological responses that are likely to cause you to gain weight back. Maybe that's less likely with the HCG, but I have a feeling that the weight gain does come back after you stop taking it. The second thing I'm concerned about with this is the amount of toxins that your body has to deal with, and the fact that this is a very, very, very low calorie diet. So if you're doing this, I think it's really important to also be doing something else along the lines of lots of fruits and vegetables, green shakes, low calorie green shakes, tinctures, whatever. But you need to get those important biodetoxification factors in, because you're going to be putting a lot of pesticides, a lot of hormone mimicry things, things that are present in our food supply that get stored in your body fat, not to mention heavy metals. All of that stuff gets dumped into your system. Your poor liver has to deal with it. Rapid weight loss does expose you to a toxicity burden. And if you aren't also consuming the things that your liver needs to deal with that, I think you could mess yourself up. I have one more email here. This is from Dick in Santa Cruz. Dick writes, New York Times article on vitamin supplements. Hi, Dr. Don. My guess is you read that New York Times article on 1012, two studies offer evidence on risks of vitamin supplements. It's a very confusing article about taking vitamin supplements. The article infers, one, taking an overdose of some vitamin supplements are not helpful, maybe even hurtful, and two, taking any vitamin supplements are not helpful. Your experience and comments, please. Well, yes, Dick, I do agree with you that that was an exceptionally poorly written article at a number of levels, including the fact that the person who wrote it didn't actually seem to understand how the statistics worked particularly well. And there was another article in Time magazine, which was even worse from the standpoint of misinterpreting the statistics. I have begun the idea as a new feature for the program that I'm going to post on my Facebook link for this show, which you can find by going to askdrdon.com and clicking on the little Facebook icon. And I'm going to start posting, taking articles and deconstructing them, and commenting on what's good about them, what's bad about them, why I think it's a solid article or why I think it's deeply flawed and should be just ignored. And in the case of this vitamin and mortality in older women, the Iowa Women's Health Study, just briefly, there are really two ways that you can make a vitamin fail automatically by study design. One is to have a very small number of people and run the study for a short duration. Then there's a failure of the two trend lines. Even if there is a difference between the two groups, there isn't enough time for the trend lines to diverge, so they don't separate out. Statistically speaking, it's a non-differential study. The second way that you can do it is that you can have an enormously large N, and a large number of people in a study magnifies small, possibly even random variations, and it leads to statistical significance. But from the standpoint of clinical significance, it's meaningless. So if you see an N on a study of more than 10,000, you're getting into trouble in terms of amplifying statistical noise. So unmeaningful, fluky things about poor randomization and other types of technical flaws are going to be magnified. And I think in this study, there's a lot of things wrong with the study, but the chief thing is this isn't even a random study. And because it's such a huge N, any variation in that initial randomization, in other words, were the two groups, the group that took vitamins and the group that didn't take vitamins, were they different? Well, in this case, yes, automatically from the get-go, the people who take vitamins are different than the people who don't take vitamins. And you have so many people that it's going to be completely flawed. 60-year-old woman feels a little tired, doesn't feel healthy, so she starts taking some vitamins. Well, maybe she's tired and not feeling healthy for a reason that might lead to increased mortality. 41% of the people in the study died in the 20 years they were studied. So that's a lot of deaths. It allows for small variations to get magnified as a fluke, and it doesn't mean anything. There's lots of other things that I would be putting in that analysis. I don't want to belabor the point here, but there's more information on the vitamin E and prostate cancer study, which also came out this week. And if you tune in next week, you'll hear an analysis of that. Our first caller is Maria Elena in Salinas.
This is rather odd, and I'm just calling to find out if it's normal. There are parts of my scalp, the same areas, that are feel lumpy, like swollen, and I press on them and they feel sore. Not like other parts of my scalp. I can press, you know, here and there on my head, and it doesn't mean anything. I don't feel a thing. But there are parts that when I press, they just feel like, I don't know, they feel sore.
Are these areas consistently the same areas?
Yes.
And how long have this been something you've been aware of?
Oh, gosh, months and months.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is muscle attachments on the skull. So there are areas on your head, your temples, for example. Most people have tender temples. The back of your head, where your visual cortex is, where the strong muscles of your neck attach, behind your ears is another spot. And wherever you have muscle attachments going into bone, there's an opportunity for muscle tension and traction to actually irritate the attachment point. So think of a tree and the roots of the tree going into the ground, and a strong wind blows the tree. Well, where the roots go in, the ground gets a little lifted or pulled on or yanked on. And that sort of thing can activate the nerves and cause an irritant. So that's number one. Number two, of course, is you get into this concept of qi and the acupuncture meridians. And there are, hundreds of acupuncture points on the scalp. So it would be interesting to see whether, let's suppose that you have pain running down the outside of your leg where the tuxedo stripe would be if you were wearing tuxedo pants. At the same time, you might find that there's pain right at the corner of the eyeball and also up on the scalp at the hairline and maybe at the back of your neck where the trapezius attaches. Those would all be on the gallbladder meridian. So because I'm also an acupuncturist, when someone comes in with that complaint, I might check other parts of their body and see is the meridian generally tender, because that would indicate that there's something up with that meridian that maybe the qi needs to be balanced or an acupuncture treatment would be advisable. There are also other schools of this. There are people who use the scalp as a reflex thing, like, you know, the reflexology where people say, well, the bottom of the foot corresponds, this part corresponds to the liver and this part corresponds to the backbone and so. And there's a school of Korean hand acupuncture that does the same thing with little tiny needles, and they'll treat back pain by putting a needle in your middle finger, which apparently works. So who am I to, you know, if it works, I'm not going to argue too loudly about it because I'm seeing it as a benign intervention. With respect to should you worry about this, only if the area in question seems to be enlarging. And if the area in question is getting bigger, then you have to worry about something rare and weird, like a tumor or a scalp cyst or something else that needs medical attention. Okay? So as long as it's stable, I wouldn't worry too much about it. And sometimes if you just massage those areas, they get better.
Okay, that's okay.
All right, give that a try and call us back. Let us know what happens in a few weeks, okay?
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is turning out to be quite a show about DNA and genetics. So I have two more interesting studies. We've really got the tools now to start looking in the bloodstream for gene products. This one could be really important in the long run. It's about Huntington's disease, which is a horrible degenerative disease that is autosomally inherited. It's autosomal dominant, which is bad in the sense that you have a 50% chance of getting it from your parent as opposed to a 25% with a autosomal recessive. So that's bad. And it causes early dementia and is altogether a very, very nasty neurodegenerative disease that we would love to find good treatment for. The problem is, how do you know if your treatment is working? And in the case of a disease like this, you have to wait until the person develops the dementia, at which point it's probably too late to know if your treatment was working. So it's difficult to study. researchers have been looking for a biomarker for this disease, and they think they may have found it. It's a gene called H2AFY, and it's overexpressed in Huntington's disease patients. That means they have many more copies of the product of this gene in their bloodstream. Now, if you have that around, you can test for it. Turns out that there's a rat model for Huntington's disease that also overexpresses this, which tends to validate the rat model as far as being valid for drug testing initially. And it also gives us something we can hook onto. If we can show that a drug, and in this case they have, the drug is called sodium phenylbutyrate. And this is a simple enough molecule. They've shown that it reduces the expression of this DNA in patients who receive the drug. Now, we need long-term study to be sure that correlates with the difference in development of the dementing illness. But again, a new biomarker for a terrible disease is a very helpful and fascinating thing. Another trend that's happening with this idea of personalized genetics or reading the DNA involves cancer. Now, it turns out that cancers, while they start out with all the same DNA that you have in your body cells, the DNA mutates. So a lot of times, the copy of a growth suppressor gene or the copy of an anti-proliferative gene gets lost in translation, if you will, and damaged. Now, you no longer have the gene to stop the growth of the cell, and that cell itself becomes immortalized and becomes a cancer. There are a lot of monoclonal antibodies and new drugs being developed. And the idea is, will they work for the entire population of people with the cancer? And they don't. They don't achieve statistical significance. But there's a small subgroup that does. Why is that? Well, it turns out that they may have a special copy of damaged DNA. Melanomas, for example, often have a mutation in a gene called BRAF. If you have a BRAF positive mutation in your melanoma, then there's a drug called Zelboraf that works really well, but only if you have that mutation. In the same case, if there's an ALK mutation, this is a type of phosphate transfer gene called a kinase. If you have this particular kinase in your small cell lung cancer, then another monoclonal antibody works really well for this kind of cancer. So now the drug companies are actually developing drugs and diagnostic tests to identify the people who are going to benefit from the drugs at the same time. You know, you can get cynical about big pharma, but when we're talking about coming up with life-saving cancer chemotherapies that target intelligently the DNA of the cancer, I'm all for this trend, and I hope to see more of these test and drug combos coming down the pike, because it's certainly a lot better than a shotgun in a dark room, which is the current state of affairs in cancer therapy. I thought I'd take a moment and give you a little overview of the research on probiotics. We have talked about probiotics in the very general many times on this program, but I wanted to talk about what research exists for specific diseases and specific probiotics. So I want to start out with one called VSL number 3. And this is a product that contains four different lactobacillus organisms. And in multiple randomized placebo-controlled trials, it's been shown to be very good for inflammation in ulcerative colitis. Now, that's inflammatory bowel disease. The data on this is very strong, multiple studies, different centers, and non-commercial interests. So this is something that you can really bank on. Another really well-supported probiotic is Saccharomyces boulardii, and this has been shown in a number of studies to prevent the recurrent Clostridium difficile infection. Now, C. difficile is an opportunistic organism that moves in when you take antibiotics and wipe out your natural gut flora. This one is resistant to most antibiotics, so it's the only man left standing, so to speak, and it grows like crazy, infects the gut, and then once it's taken hold, you can treat it with antibiotics like metronidazole and vancomycin, but it comes back frequently, sometimes 2, 3, 4 recurrences. Basically, it's like weeds in your garden at that point. This is a serious disorder, and to have a yeast effectively that reduces recurrence rate is huge, and I recommend this whenever I put someone in the hospital and give them IV antibiotics. I put them on this because it's one of the few probiotics that's actually approved for hospital use, and so I can get a hold of it and give it. Other things that you might be interested in, there's a probiotic called Ganodin. It's a pantogenic strain of Bacillus coagulans, and it has a double-blind placebo-controlled study showing it to be effective treatment for abdominal pain and bloating in patients with irritable bowel syndrome. Now, I've also used just the regular probiotic formulas that I talk about on this program and essentially found it to be quite helpful for the irritable bowel syndrome. So if you have that, you should be taking 25 to 30 billion organisms mixed flora, if not this particular product. There's good data on Actimel, which is a yogurt-type drink. This has been given to people in the hospital and has been shown in placebo studies to prevent hospital-acquired diarrhea and also in the prevention, again, of C. difficile. So this is Lactobacillus casei immunitas. When I was first starting out in medicine, we had just really gotten the ability to get really early premature babies to survive in the neonatal intensive care unit. The procedures had been elaborated, and suddenly we were getting babies born at 28 weeks of gestation who were actually making it through. And the question that was on all of our minds at that time was, well, how are these babies going to do when they're 5 years old, when they're 10 years old? Are they going to have problems as adults? We didn't know. A generation later, we have a lot of information about that. And the answer is, some of them do amazingly well, and some of them have problems like vision issues or hearing issues. But if they make it through, even if they've got those vision or hearing issues, their brains are capable of compensating. To my knowledge, this is the first study using MRI scans looking at brain growth rates. And they studied 82 infants who were born before 30 weeks of gestational age. And they monitored their brain growth starting from the time that they reached their, basically their full gestational age. So if you're born at 30 weeks, we start monitoring at 40 weeks and we're watching how fast your brain grows. And what they see is that brain growth catches up in most kids. And in fact, you can track the rate that their brain grows and see that the rate of brain growth really predicts how they're going to do in cognitive testing, language, attention, and memory at both 2 years and 6 years. So what this means is that we can find and target the preemies who are the ones who are going to be at risk, and we can do targeted early intervention, maybe puzzles and testing and extra tutoring to accelerate that brain growth. Plus, we can track our interventions with brain growth. It turns out that, and this is the scary thing, I guess you could consider it scary. I think it's very powerful, but it's also a little biology is destiny. If you have a 5 to 10% reduction in the surface area of the cerebral cortex at the full term age, so in other words, if you don't catch up in that first 10 weeks between the 30 weeks and the 40 weeks, then you have a one standard deviation lower on your intelligence scores at the age of six. In other words, that's 15 to 20 IQ points. That's a lot of IQ points. And since we can figure out who's going to have that at the age of 40 weeks, we can do our early intervention and maybe ameliorate that shift. So important information. Let's go to Pat in Aromas. Hello, Pat. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
I've had a pain in my shoulder. I do a lot of yoga. I've got a referral for an MRI. I feel like I'd like to be able to get to physical therapy without doing that. And I'm wondering if you can suggest a process to use with my primary care doctor that might help me to get the outcome that I want.
All right. So if I understand your question correctly, you don't want the MRI, and
right,
you are willing to do physical therapy and try to heal your shoulder.
Yes.
Okay. So first question I have is, let's see if we can do this over the telephone. Okay. Probably I can tell you about the test, and then you can look it up online and watch a video of someone doing it. YouTube has multiple excellent videos of the shoulder examination, and I've used them when I've taught physical examination classes to acupuncture students. So if you go to YouTube and search shoulder examination, you'll see a bunch of ones. The one you're looking for is called the beer can test. Now imagine that you had a beer can in your hand and you were dumping it out. So you turn your hand over, the thumb would be facing down, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you put your arms out at about a 45-degree angle, straight out in front of you and down 45 degrees, and you assume that dumping the beer can pose, and then you lift your arms up. As you'll see it on YouTube, it's hard to describe over the phone. If someone's giving you resistance as you raise your arms, and you raise your arm and it hurts, that's a shoulder impingement. If you're weak, not just in pain, but also weaker on that side, then you probably have an actual tear in the shoulder. And that's the deciding factor in my practice. If someone fails the beer can test, I want them to get the MRI. If they pass the beer can test, I'm fine with putting some steroids in their shoulder or not, doing some acupuncture in their shoulder or not, or just sending them to physical therapy and having them work on the shoulder. If they fail the beer can test, I'm worried that the physical therapy may actually erode the tendon further or lead to a complete tear, and I don't want to do that. So you got a medical legal barrier there on the part of the practitioner and also on the physical therapist for not wanting to be blamed for an adverse outcome.
Great.
Okay.
That's fabulous. I will go to my YouTube and review what you said and then know why I'm going to go for an MRI or talk with my practitioner about why I'd rather not do the MRI and go right to physical therapy.
Yeah, if you really want to impress your primary care doctor, say, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with my supraspinatus, so I'd just like to do physical therapy.
Great. Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. There's such a great intimidation value on a five-syllable word. And I was taught this by a very bad doctor when I was in training. He was not quite a quack. He was a very terrible doctor, but he was very successful financially and in terms of his reputation with his patients. His reputation with the other doctors stank. But, you know, you can learn a lot from people like that. He taught me two things. He taught me always touch the pain. The patient comes in and says, my elbow hurts, and you know it's because it's the disc in their neck. Touch the elbow. Examine the elbow, because the patient needs you to touch their pain and then figure out what's causing it. But always touch the pain. This is an extremely good bit of advice. The second thing that he taught me was, if you want to intimidate somebody who's being hostile, use a lot of five-syllable words rapidly, and they'll back down because they get challenged and intimidated. And it's a beautiful way to intimidate people who are being hostile. Of course, it could get you beat up in a bar, so you want to be careful about that. But in a medical clinical situation, it's a great strategy. We're going to take one more call real quick. Gail in Pacific Grove.
Hello.
Hello, Gail. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a bladder infection, and I've taken Cipro for it, and it's come back. And I tried the old cranberry juice treatment, and it seemed to work for a couple days. And now I'm feeling the pressure and the soreness again.
Okay. So how many days of Cipro, and how long after the Cipro that the symptoms came back?
They never really went away.
All right. So we have to say that it's quite possible you have a antibiotic-resistant organism. Unfortunately, in my opinion, Cipro should not be used as a first-line drug for bladder infections because the bacteria rapidly become resistant to it. It should certainly never be used twice in the same year unless you have somebody who's got so many other drug allergies that your back is really against the wall. So the first move is confirm that there's actually an infection there with a urinalysis and a microscopic exam. That's important because women often will have vaginal mucus drop into their urine and they'll have a false positive dipstick. If you've been off antibiotics for at least 3 days, that urine should grow bacteria if there are bacteria to be grown. You have to consider that you might have chlamydia, which could cause bladder symptoms. You might have a resistant organism. You might have something else going on like herpes in the urethra that's giving you bladder infection symptoms, but in fact is not being caused by a bacteria. What happens in this circumstance is one has to widen one's differential and think about other possibilities.
Okay.
Okay?
So I have to go back to the doctor then.
You have to go back to the doctor. Sorry, but it's true.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. For those listeners who do get the program on the podcast, I want to send a shout out to you. Thank you very much for subscribing and listening. I'm glad you're out there. I'm thrilled when I get emails from Saudi Arabia or Africa or other places over the globe. But I also want to point out that there's a great wealth of content up there on the web, but somebody has to pay for it. And it is so important to keep this station going as a resource, because this is my launch point. This is where the tree roots go into the ground and suck up nourishment. This is where the electricity comes from. This is where the microphone and the board and other things, the telephones.
And the podcasting, someone puts it there, right?
Exactly.
I mean, we pay costs.
That actually happens behind the scenes. It's not free. And I really need you to step up to the plate. It's so easy to donate. What is it worth to you? You can use any currency. We have one world here as far as the internet is concerned. So I have been gifting you. I need to ask you to give something back. What you can afford, some acknowledgement, some kind of atta girl, keep going. And also, it's not just for my ego. It's really practically to keep the lights on, to keep the electricity flowing so that we can keep the information flowing to you.
Whether it's a dollar a week or a dollar a day, we just ask that you speak up and vote your support for Ask Dr. Don and for KUSP. We thank all of the callers and online pledgers who have given today. Anytime, always online at kusp.org.
And I want to thank you very much, Sean Rameshwaram, for helping with the program today.
Thank you, Don.
This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.